My name is Bruce Berner from Valparaiso University in Indiana. And the title of tonight is O.J., Bernie Goetz, and Other Legal Celebrities. I want to start by thanking all of you for being here. I know that I am in competition with the snack bar. This is one of the tougher slots to get. I want to talk generally about some issues that came out of both the cases of O.J. Simpson, who I'm sure you all know, and Bernie Goetz, who I think most of you know. In 1984, Bernie was riding the subway in New York City, and four African-American teenagers came toward Bernie and asked him for $5. In his mind, he was about to be murderously attacked or maimed. He had previously armed himself. He shot four of them, all four of them, wounding three of them, one of them very seriously, and was prosecuted in the state of New York for attempted murder. The case drew a tremendous amount of publicity at that time because it had many features which made it newsworthy. The racial question was very clearly presented. Some of the terror of urban life that many people felt at that time was churned up. After two trials, Bernard Goetz was finally acquitted of attempted murder. He was convicted on a very minor charge of carrying a weapon, which did not even amount to jail time. But on the basic charge of attempted murder, he was acquitted, principally on the theory of self-defense. And whether or not self-defense should have worked under those circumstances was a major subject of the appellate decision. Law students read about that case, particularly in regard to how the law of self-defense works. And a little bit later on, I'll come back to that and talk a little more about it. The reason we've heard about Bernie lately is a civil suit, which had been filed by one of the then boys, now a 30-year-old man, was tried late in 1995 and resulted in a civil verdict against Bernie Goetz for both compensatory damages, and they were huge. The 30-year-old victim is a quadriplegic as a result of the attack. And that, together with the punitive damages awarded in the case, came to $50 million. Bernie Goetz was scarcely worth $50. At the time, and is in the process of filing bankruptcy, and so the actual damages awarded in that case won't be recovered. But the fact is that the jury in the civil case found him liable. The jury in the criminal case had found him not liable. As we all know, the jury in O.J. Simpson's criminal case found him not guilty, and we now know that he is the subject of a series of civil suits in a variety of states, and we don't know how they will come out, but I would be willing to predict that judgments will be taken in those cases in favor of the plaintiffs. And O.J. Simpson is still worth a little more than Bernie Goetz, not worth as much as when he started, but certainly worth something, and so those verdicts may actually have some meaning for those plaintiffs other than a kind of a symbolic or a principled meaning. I wanted to deal initially with some issues that I know have troubled people about those cases, and principally O.J. O.J. is more in our common consciousness. One of the interesting things about using O.J. Simpson for a gathering of this type is that you don't have to do any pre-teaching. You don't have to say, oh, please read an article about this, or could you please bone up on this? We didn't so much read about this case as we lived this case. You couldn't help, even if you tried to avoid it, and I did. I did because primarily I didn't want to have to answer students' questions every day. Why did this lawyer do that? Why did they do that? Do you think he did it? As if that one's the one that always got me, as if somehow a law professor in northern Indiana would have some inside information about how these killings actually took place. And I would always tell them, no, there's a gentleman in Louisiana who actually committed these crimes, and you'll be hearing about him. And they'd look at me, just what kind of thing is that to say? Here are some of the issues that I think people are concerned about. First of all, how are different results possible in the criminal case and then in the subsequent civil case that are brought? How could it be that Bernie's not guilty when we try him criminally, but liable when we try him civilly? Why are we still trying O.J.'s case? Isn't that over? And you may remember the aftermath of the Rodney King criminal case with the policeman, then turned into a subsequent civil case. That one turned out differently, too. And that one was in Los Angeles, and I want to make the assertion tonight that the tail of that case was felt in O.J.'s case in a number of ways. Rodney King cast a specter across the O.J. trial that was sometimes pretty obvious and sometimes pretty nuanced, as we'll see in some procedural decisions. How are the results possibly different? Well, for one thing, the issues are a little bit different. The legal issues that are involved in the criminal case are a bit different than they are in the civil case. Usually a plaintiff in a civil case has to prove less than a prosecutor has to prove to win a criminal conviction. For one thing, civil cases, which are called tort cases, torts are not a dessert served at Holden, that's just the name for a civil action for damages. Ordinarily, you don't have to prove to win those cases intention. If you get into a car accident and the other person who hit you was careless, you don't have to show that they hit you on purpose. It's enough to show that they were careless or negligent, which is the legal word. The other thing that's very significant is in civil cases, the actions of the victim become important. They become legally significant. If you get into a car accident in which the other person is careless, but you're careless too, and help cause the accident, your recovery gets deducted based on how much of the accident was your fault, so we can apportion it. We don't care about that in criminal cases, because the victim's actions are irrelevant. What if the victim did contribute? The only key in a criminal case is, should the defendant be punished? The criminal case is not there, after all, to compensate the victim. So that's different. The focus of the lawsuit is different, and that's the main thing. The basic philosophy of what the lawsuit about is different. In a criminal case, the focus is the defendant punishable? Is the defendant a suitable candidate for the kind of punishment that the system metes out? In a civil case, the main focus is the plaintiff compensable? That turns a little bit on the fault of the defendant, but now we get very much more focused on the individual damage that has been suffered by the victim. So in that case, it's different. The procedures are different, too, and here hangs a tale. Talk about different levels of proving things and different levels of confidence or assuredness. We start at the top, and I imagine the most confident we can be of anything is to be certain of. There are a very short list of things of which I'm certain, and on some days the list is blank. Okay? Not certain quite about anything, depending on how rigorously you want to be about the word certain. But at least we can arrive at something that we understand may not theoretically be certain. But there are things that we have enough faith in, enough confidence in, that we say we're certain about them. Actually, a real good theologian would probably tell you that faith is above certainty, or at least that it's on a plane different from certainty. But in non-theological circles, certainty is as good as it gets. We have never required certainty for anything in the law, and I think you know why. We could simply never deliver on it. The highest standard that's ever been required to prove anything in the history of Anglo-American jurisprudence, and we are very Eurocentric in the law business, sorry, but that's where we get it, is a standard called beyond a shadow of a doubt. We don't use that anymore, but it has some historical roots. That was the standard in common law England for proof of treason. And the penalty for treason was so high that it was believed you need to have a very, very high standard of proof, because we were going to kill the person we convicted for starters. For openers, you die. After that, we take all of your property that would otherwise go to your heirs, and we escheat that to the crown. That's number two. And number three, we bury you under the highway, just so we get a little moral indignity there at the end. That was, I think, the original three strikes and you're out. Or three strikes and you're under. I don't know. At any rate, that treason was, because the penalty was so high, we wanted to be absolutely certain not to deliver it to people who didn't deserve it. And because the penalty was so high and we wanted to be confident, we create this high standard. The next one down, and the one that we're familiar with, is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the classic Anglo-American standard for proof in a criminal case. How high is it? Hard to say. You're not allowed to put a number to it. That's heresy. If you ever try to give a number for the jury, this means 90%, this means 70%, this means 99%, the case is reversed and you start all over. It's not a numerical idea. We do know, however, that it's more than 50%, because underneath beyond a reasonable doubt is a standard called, this is failure of pen here. Maybe Reb's the magic one, right? Clear and convincing evidence. There are certain kind of lawsuits in which you have to prove your case to what's called clear and convincing. That's less than beyond a reasonable doubt. The one that we use in most civil trials is called preponderance of the evidence, and that's the one that you can put a number to. That's beyond 50%. Evidence preponderates if it's more probably true than not true. So that's a nice, easy one. We all get into that one with the math business. We get some standards in the law that are lower than that. Probable cause, which is a pretrial standard. That's the standard for arresting people. That's the standard for getting a search warrant to search their houses, et cetera, et cetera. We get a standard called reasonable suspicion, which is basically the standard that says when a policeman can stop you on the street and ask some questions, detain you against your will, but not yet arrest you. And then there's a few lower ones yet. Now, the interesting thing about all this, notice the difference here. In the civil cases of Bernie Getz and O.J. Simpson, this is the one that's going to apply. We don't know what number goes here, but we know this is significantly higher. I ran a study about 4 years ago on what number, what percentage people thought beyond a reasonable doubt should be. And we sent it around to a lot of different people in the system and out of the system. When you sent it to people out of the system, you found answers anywhere from 55% to 99.99%. When you sent it to prosecutors, you'd get a number like 60%. When you send it to defense counsel, would you be surprised that you get point and then a lot of nines? Okay. So, you know, how high you think it is numerically is sort of a function of where you are. But let's say it's 80. And by the way, that's not a bad average. Not a bad average. Notice there's 30% of the cases that fall in between there. So at least numerically, it's possible that there will be many cases, since most cases which go to trial at all are fairly close. Because if they're not fairly close, usually there's a way to get those cases out of the system. We usually settle them one way or other. Murder cases are hard to settle for reasons we'll talk about. So at least you shouldn't be totally surprised then to find that there are going to be cases where you get a criminal acquittal followed by liability in a civil case. One thing that we talked about earlier in the week, and I left you with a question, I think it was on Monday, which kind of error do you think is worse, convicting innocent people or acquitting guilty people? Whenever you have a system that can generate mistakes in either direction, what game theorists call false positives and false negatives. A false positive, let us say, would be convicting someone who's factually innocent. A false negative would be acquitting someone who is factually guilty. If you have a system which is capable of producing both results, and you find that one of those results is more repugnant to you, the only thing you can do now is bias the system. And you bias the system so that you drive down the number of mistakes you don't want to make. It was a saying in England that went this way: better that 10 guilty men walk free than that one innocent man go to prison. They were very hung up on men. Women didn't figure in those little aphorisms. These were all 17th century. I don't know where they came up with 10. Or maybe 7. Maybe 18, depending on. But the point is, the more that you want to guard against getting false positives, the more false negatives you will generate as night follows day. That's just the way math is. If you want to make absolutely certain that you never got a false positive, you'd have enormous numbers of false negatives. Right? And that's part of the problem. Lord Devlin had one of the great answers when they asked him, how many guilty men do you think should walk free before an innocent man goes to jail? He said, I'd like to know what the guilty men were doing first. That sort of matters. The comparison isn't as clean as all that. So the procedural difference, I think, is important in recognizing the difference between the two kinds. Some hard lessons from O.J.'s case, and we'll come back to Bernie Goetz later. Racism lives, sexism lives, regionalism lives, every kind of prejudice that you can imagine lives. And I want to say that people came at O.J.'s case in either what I call a dishonest way or an honest way. If you come at it in a dishonest way, you come at it and you hear the basic allegations and the basic facts and you say, I want him to turn out guilty, or I want him to turn out not guilty. And some people do that, and you will not shake them from that, and of course everything that they see will be seen through the lens of what they want. My contention is, even if we are honest about it, even if we say, let's look at the evidence, let's not prejudge the case, let's wait for the evidence, we are still very likely to make the first kind of error. I'll read you a paragraph from a book called Miracles by C.S. Lewis. Many of you may have read it. And I've found over the week that C.S. Lewis is not a particular favorite up here at Holden Village, but he's sort of a favorite of mine. And this book is a book about whether or not there are miracles. And the way that the case was being argued at the time that he wrote this, and certainly the argument that that David Hume had made against miracles, which was the classic argument, began, it said, by looking at the evidence for miracles or lack of miracles. Certainly that's what historians do. They look at the evidence. Then they make their judgments. Here's what Lewis says. The question whether miracles occur can never be answered simply by experience, or we would say in the legal business, never simply by evidence. Every event which might claim to be a miracle is, in the last resort, something presented to our senses, something seen, heard, touched, smelled, or tasted. And our senses are not infallible. If anything extraordinary seems to have happened, we can always say that we have been the victims of an illusion. If we hold a philosophy which excludes the supernatural, this is what we will always say. Isn't that wonderful? What we learn from experience depends on the kind of philosophy we bring to experience. It is therefore useless to appeal to evidence before we have settled, as well as we can, the philosophical questions. My point is, whatever sort of pre-notions that you brought to the O.J. case, you were very likely to impose them on the case and read the evidence in that light. Some of you probably did better than others in filtering that out and getting down to as blank a slate as you could possibly. You don't want to become an absolute blank slate, okay? Because then you can't even understand the language, okay? So at least you have to have some language or something. Let me give you an example of what I mean. When we found out that Mark Furman had used the N-word many, many times in this manuscript, what did you make of that? Let me suggest that what you make of it, made of that, and that's the same fact, we all heard it. What you made of that depended on what philosophy you had before you heard it. If you believed that O.J. was guilty, that O.J. had done it, then your immediate reaction to hearing this evidence of Mark Furman's racism was to say, well, yeah, I mean, he's a racist, but what does that have to do with the evidence? That is to say, you were in a position to interpret that out as not having much meaning because you could say it isn't directly relevant to the case. What, however, if you started looking at that case with the presupposition that the police were liars and had set O.J. up from the beginning? Now here's a person who takes the stand and says, I am not a racist. In fact, I have never used that word. I talked to Jerry Uhlman, who was one of the lawyers for O.J. in that case, and it certainly had been my guess that they had this McKinney book long before, because Bailey was so careful. You never said the word in the last 10 years, in the last 5. Now, are we sure what the word is? And he spelled it for them, you know. Well, when a lawyer does something that carefully, you always suspect something's coming. It turns out they didn't have the McKinney book at that point. They were fishing. That's one of those questions that lawyers say it can't hurt to ask. There's an old trial lawyer aphorism, never ask questions you don't know the answer to. That's why lawyers are different from everybody else. Everybody else asks questions when they don't know the answer. Most of us assume that's the purpose for asking questions. Lawyers ask them, trial lawyers, only when they know the answer or when the answer doesn't matter. They felt the answer to this question didn't matter because either Mark would say, yes, he's used the word, that's a good answer for the defendant, or he would deny it and the jury wouldn't believe it. He's a tough L.A. cop and he's never used that word? Come on. Oh, one of my favorite questions where it doesn't matter what the answer is in a slip and fall case. Somebody slips and falls in the supermarket on the sidewalk and they bring a suit. Here's the question. Did you see what you fell, what you slipped on before you slipped on? There is no good answer to that question. If you say no, they say, well, why weren't you looking? If they say yes, you say, well, if you saw it, why didn't you walk it? To slip on it. But they took a chance on this N-word business. The McKinney book shows up in the mail. Now, if you started by thinking that the police had set O.J. up, now you get this McKinney book, now you get Furman made a liar on the stand, and you go, there it is. I had some students come to me that day and say, well, do you think they'll dismiss the case? In all honesty, did I think that the case would be dismissed once the Furman book came out? But notice, if you start with believing that the police had set him up, that's not a very bad question to ask. If you start by thinking he's guilty, you go, oh, what's this? And, oh, he's a racist policeman. What does that have to do with O.J.? But again, that's part of the whole business of a lot of what we get out of the case is what we bring to the case. We'll talk a little more about that. Another hard lesson. Money matters. Money matters. We talked a little bit about that before. So I'm going to make a contribution to Holden to get that better pen. We could all go together on this. When we talk about
those are all.
No, we got enough here. When we talk about kind of odd markets, where we know at certain levels there are going to be market failures, and so we manipulate the market a little bit to serve some other social ends. We have to be worried about both about the minimum and the maximum. In this country, if you are charged with a crime that can send you to jail, whether or not you have cash, you will get legal representation. If you are indigent by federal standards, a lawyer will be appointed for you. Okay. A competent lawyer, a qualified lawyer, probably an overworked lawyer. But the legal services people have this terrible rap and history of being a sort of a lesser grade. It isn't so. They're fine lawyers. The money usually doesn't let them have a small enough caseload. So what we've said is, at the minimum level, everybody is entitled to minimum representation. And even though the market wouldn't do that, I mean, if you let this go to market forces, some people couldn't afford any legal help at all. Now the question becomes, do you want to monitor the maximum side too? Do you want to fix the market there too? And have a rule that says nobody can spend more than X for a lawyer? Think about health care. I bet if I said in America today, I have a way to make this work where everybody will get a minimum amount of health care whether they can pay for it or not. If I could show that I could do this fiscally, I don't think there'd be much political objection, do you? But what if I said, in order to make this work, we also have to make it clear that there's a maximum amount of health care that anybody can get, even if they could pay for it. You can't get this. Have you seen how the politics of that one has worked? About the choice? And you know what choice means. Choice means, you know, we have enough money to get more than the maximum, more than what everybody else can get. Oh, isn't it wonderful that these people can get this minimal care? So, you know, when you say money matters in a criminal case, you're not really talking about down here, you're really talking about up here. Part of the idea of beyond a reasonable doubt, by the way, is an assumption that was true in England and is true in many cases today, and that is that the prosecution would have more resources than the defense. They get started earlier, and the police are the first on the scene, they get to the evidence first, they get started earlier, the defense counsel isn't in the picture sometimes for a month, so the defense counsel's way behind. Classically, the state had a lot more resources and a lot more money than the defendant. Part of our system and our constitutional guarantees are put together on the assumption that the defendant is short-handed financially. When that isn't true, then the defendant kind of gets an extra advantage. The defendant has the resources, and he's playing by a set of rules that assumed he didn't have the resources. That's part of why money matters a great deal, and he, you know, he had a great legal team. There's just no question about it. He had a great legal team. I want to one of the things I had advertised, not on the board, but in the deep copy, where I gave long explanations and then they cut them down, put them on the kiosk because they don't fit. Is I promised a secret about the case, and I'll deliver that. This came out of our conversation with Jerry Uhlman. About a month and a half after the arrest, you may remember there was a lot of talk about a knife, which O.J. supposedly had purchased, and which was never found, right? What was found? And tonight I'm going to tell you where it was found and the circumstances under which it was found. It's a very interesting story. At this point, the police had searched the house three or four times. And when I say searched, I mean searched. One of the things that never came out is, you kill two people, and then you hurry back, you got an airplane to catch and all this stuff, and the chauffeur may or may not be there. Chances are you're going to have a lot of blood on you and on your clothes, right? No place to stop on the way. You're going to wash it out in the house, right? So what they did with the search warrant is they took every pipe out of that house, the plumbing, and they scraped it and they subjected it to all kind of chemical tests. Blood leaves traces forever. Can't get that out. Found nothing. We didn't hear anything about that. And there are reasons why the defense can't tell us that. But they found nothing. So that's very interesting. The open question of where the blood went is very interesting. But the reason I want to tell you about that is to tell you then what the police missed. After they get all the pipes, you know, and the rust, that they get, 6 weeks, and when the legal team is all together, they say to O.J., there's all this talk about this knife you bought. Did you buy a knife of the type that could have been used? And he says, yeah, I did. He said, have you ever used it? No, I have. As a matter of fact, it's still in the package. It's not even out of the shrink wrap. Really? Where is it? It's home. Well, then the police had it. O.J. says, maybe not. And he tells them where it is. It's in his bedroom. Behind a picture, there's a safe. So here's Jerry Uhlman. You remember Jerry, the white-haired older gentleman? He teaches at Santa Clara, argued a lot of the legal issues. He goes out there with a young legal intern that he's got, and they go to O.J.'s bedroom. At this point, they're allowed in. The search team is over. And they move the picture, and they open the safe, and there's the knife. When he told us this story to a group of law faculty, we all went, not because, oh, there's the knife, and everybody's wondering where the knife is, because we're all lawyers, and we know the legal dilemma that Jerry Uhlman is at that moment. He can't take it. That's evidence. And if he takes it and hides it, then he's going to jail. As Art Leff at the Yale Law School used to say, there's a whole lot of rules of legal ethics. But the number one rule of legal ethics is when it comes to that moment in time, when either your client goes to jail or you go to jail, he goes to jail. That's the first rule. So Jerry knew that. So what he did was a very interesting and I think a very adroit and very ethical. He went and hired a private investigative service, which was bonded by the state of California, with strict instructions of what they were to do. And what they were to do was to go get the knife and take it in an envelope and give it to the court. You remember that envelope that showed up to Judge Kennedy, the woman judge that had the initial stuff? That's what was in the envelope. The knife was subsequently, much later, tested and found clean. It wasn't even out of the shrink wrap. But that's kind of an interesting sidelight to the whole case. That's where that new knife was. He had purchased it as a gift. Jerry didn't say for whom. Right? He purchased it as a gift. Couple of other lessons we learned from the case. The police lie. Okay? The defendants lie. Okay? That one you probably knew all along. Right? The defendants lie because they have a reason. Right? We always know defendants lie to protect themselves. Juries know that a mother is expected to lie for her child. As a friend of mine used to say, yes, you lie for your child. It's an ethical rule. Nephew, not so clear. It's more of a borderline case. Let me just suggest a couple of other things and then throw it open. Some prosecutorial and defense decisions, tactical decisions. Oh, look at this. I've got four of these now, in the case. First, why wasn't the case settled? A lot of cases of this type are. Pleas are taken to a lesser crime or a deal is cut. I think in this case it's pretty clear why it couldn't have been settled, but that's still worth talking about. Prosecutorial decision to try the case in central Los Angeles. Under the law of California, they did not have to try it in central Los Angeles. They could have tried it in the area where the crime is alleged to have happened. And you know what the racial composition of the jury would have been if they had?
Yes.
Almost all white.
Yeah.
It would probably have been all white. There might have been one or two minorities on it. But the prosecutor chose not to try it in that jury pool environment, chose to try it in central Los Angeles. Interesting question. Why? Why? We'll talk about that. I think there is a very noble reason that could be asserted and a very bad reason that could be asserted. Why does the prosecutor give up so early on the death penalty? We almost forget that that was an issue.
Yeah.
So much happened after that, we almost forget. What are the tactics involved in not just giving up on the death penalty, but giving up on it way before you have to? Interesting issues. I'll hang on that one. One which just I've never gotten a sufficient answer to, other than I think a terrible mistake was made. Why does the prosecution never put on evidence of the flight? In criminal cases, if the defendant breaks and runs after the event, that's powerful evidence of a consciousness of guilt. Why is it the jury never hears about the slow Bronco chase and the run? By the way, have you ever seen the list of what was found in the car when they got it?
Passport.
Masks, passport, huge amount of cash, huge by my standards, maybe not by OJ's standards. Might have been a weekend for him. I don't know. A lot of cash. Okay. The jury never hears that. Why? That's a question. From the defense side, why does OJ never take the stand? And were they wise? See, it's easy now to say, well, of course he shouldn't take the stand. Of course it was wise. But you see, the case is over now. And you have to decide whether or not to put your client on the stand before the case is over. Okay? It's a harder call before the case is over. Right? One other thing, and then we'll open it. Are there any special problems that are occasioned when celebrities are the subject of lawsuits? People who are in the public eye before the case starts. Sometimes the case makes a person into a celebrity. But what about people who are celebrities beforehand? What effect does that have? I'll tell you the one that I noticed in the OJ case. In most cases, you would not be able to get in the evidence that the prosecution got in this case about the prior domestic assaults and beatings. They're considered to be prior crimes and bad acts or character evidence, and we usually keep that away from the jury. There's a slim argument in there that this one showed motive, which is one safe harbor through the character evidence rule. But I think in this case, why the prosecution fought so hard to get it in and why the judge probably let it in is because OJ starts with this celebrity status that is sort of artificial in itself. I mean, I was in Shea Stadium when he broke the record going over 2,000 yards. He went nuts. He was a tremendous football player. So everybody has this image of him, and then he's running through airports for whichever car company it is. Hurt. Yeah. The prosecution felt, and they said this later, that we had to get all this negative character evidence in just to start even. And that's all we wanted it to do, and Judge Ito basically says that he let it in this case because he felt that the prosecution had a disadvantage because of the celebrity status. Let me stop and throw it open and see what kind of questions, comments, what kind of things do we want to talk more about? Yes, sir.
Something I've noticed you haven't said anything about is the DNA evidence. That, for me, was settled the case. I cannot fathom how you could possibly ignore the evidence.
I talked to a colleague of mine on the law faculty. He's an African American, and he followed this trial pretty closely. And I talked to him about it too. I asked him why the DNA evidence appears not to have persuaded the African American community as it seems to have persuaded many in the majority community. And he said, "Well, first of all, it's not any disbelief in science. The African Americans have just as strong a faith in experts in science as everybody else, and we send our brightest and best to medical school and in chemistry departments and physics departments. So it's not as if we don't believe in chemistry." Their belief is that there's nothing wrong with the DNA test. The question is, where'd the blood come from, and was it set up from the beginning? Here's an interesting thing. Those tests aren't done until well after his arrest. When he's arrested, they take a lot of his blood for sampling against known samples. That's why the defense was so concerned with how much blood was in that bottle and how the milliliters were going down. If you start with a perception that the police are going to set him up, then the easiest way to set him up is to put his blood on the gloves. How do you get his blood? You collect it from him for testing. Put it on the gloves. Then you give it to the DNA tester. After that, it's all clean. After that, it's all science. That's the way they see that happen. There's a lot of argument about whether it could have happened that way. One of the problems I had initially with the defense theory of the case from day one, which was a police conspiracy, is I had a hard time following the theory, because you can either adopt the theory that the police are inept or that the police are crafty, but you really shouldn't adopt both at the same time. And that's what we seem to see. My friend Derek, who's the African-American, says, well, you can make sense of it this way. You have two or three really crafty people who drive this and have a conspiracy. And the rest are all like Barney Fifes, and they're not paying much attention anyway, and so you can do that. I think that's probably true in a metropolitan police department. But that was what bothered me. The defense seemed to flip back and forth between the police are terrible conspirators and the police do everything wrong and inept. By the way, the best explanation I've heard about why they don't put on evidence of the chase has to do with police ineptitude based on the way they search the van and log the evidence afterward, that they probably contaminated their own lines of proof. That's at least possible.
Did you see the picture of O.J. wearing the ugly shoes?
No.
It was in the National Enquirer.
My subscription ran out.
And I'm not sure why it came up so late. They had pictures of him in a football stadium wearing the shoes. And they said, well...
This is before the event, I take it. Well before the event?
Yeah, this was like 73.
Oh, okay.
Or 83, sometime many years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, photo experts said these aren't retouched, you know, that they are actual photos. But said, and at the most, you can get 2 years on perjury. Because I guess
what had he said that was inconsistent with the picture?
He said he never owned any of those shoes.
Oh, this particular kind of shoe?
Yeah, it was a shoe that they searched all over, you know, went to Japan, getting the footprints. It was the $300 Italian shoes. And they had the...
When did he say that he never wore these?
I think it was in some of the pretrial stuff. He said, I've never had any shoes. Those shoes are ugly. I'd never wear those. And then sort of something like that.
Yeah, because one of the interesting things about this trial is that because it was such a public trial, and my theory is this case was tried twice. It was tried once to a jury and once to the rest of us. Unfortunately, they had to do this at the same time. That's clumsy. Because if you want to try it first to the public, then you don't have to be all laden down with rules of evidence. My goodness, they get in the way. And you could, you know, do it any way you want. But, and I've been in a case like this, we're going to talk about this next week, with a lot of media interest. And if you don't keep yourself real focused, you begin to try the case to the outside world and not to the jury that's there. The reason I asked you was the fact of the matter is, O.J., during the course of that trial, said nothing. Not only did he not testify at trial, but none of his pretrial statements ever made its way into the record. He is absolutely mute in the record. So what do his attorneys do? They figure all kinds of ways for him to talk to the public right, during the trial, but never to talk to the jury. My theory is, I've talked about this a little Monday night, if you're upset with what the jury did, I want you to consider for a moment the fact that you and the jury heard two totally different cases. Much of what we heard every night from analysts and this and that, they don't hear that. They're just, they're in a hotel room. Okay? Much of what they heard, we didn't hear. Not because the press wasn't there, but because we weren't watching. How many of us watched the real boring parts? What we think we heard, for most of us, was the highlights on the evening news. Now, here's the next thing. Does the media go into the case with a philosophy about it? And does that affect what they hear and what they tell? I'm fond of saying whenever TV covers anything, it becomes coverage of TV. I mean, that's really what they turn the issue into. But they really, really affect how the lawyers participate, how decisions are made. There are many tactical decisions in that case which would not have been made if there wasn't live coverage going on. The time, for one thing. How long should it take to try that case? We got a group of experienced trial lawyers together from the two counties around us, and we asked everybody, and we talked about it. Now, it's a complicated case. It's got DNA evidence in it, which slows it down. And it's a circumstantial evidence case, so it's not a real fast case. What we said is, two good lawyers, local case, regular jury, no publicity, 2 weeks. It's a two-week case, so basically a two-week case. Maybe a three-week case if you really get more than one expert on each side on the DNA question. How long did it take? 9 months, was it?
Some witnesses were on for 2 weeks, it seems like.
I was wondering if you would comment on Judge Ito's handling of the case, and if you were to give him a grade, ranging from A plus to E minus, what grade would you give him?
We give F's at Valpo. I don't know about this E. Where's that E coming? We give F's. I mean, you know, if you can't cut it, you can't cut it. I would give, first of all, I wouldn't give him more than a grade. All teachers will break this down. At least I will break this down. I'll give him an A in terms of the legal rulings. He's a very astute judge. His legal rulings, for the most part, were, I think, right on. His handling of what evidence was admissible and not was not quite impeccable, but almost impeccable. I mean, he must have made 10,000 decisions, so a couple of them are going to be wrong. I thought where I'd give him a C minus, I'm an easy grader, is in taking control of the trial early enough. I don't think he ever took control of the lawyers and control of the press early enough. He let them run amok, and by golly, they did. And they ran him. So I think that was, in my mind, the worst was that he didn't really take very powerful control of the courtroom. And you see what happens when you don't take control early? You end up late having people take out their checkbooks and write a check for $50 or $250. Remember that nonsense at the end when they would get contemptuous? Pay the clerk. I mean, $250 for these people? What, this is going to stop them tomorrow? Given what they're making on the case? I think if he had taken control of that early, that would have helped. So I think it's a tough thing to do, too. I thought he was pretty fair with his rulings. I think he got a little caught up in the media, too. I think he finally began to see himself as a TV personality. That's why a lot of states won't let cameras in the courtroom. Not because they don't want the public to see it, but because of the effect it has on the participants. Where it's very hard to be a judge in a case of that magnitude. But what if, in addition to be a judge, now you must be a TV producer? Because when you're the judge, you have to do that too. You tell them when they can turn them on, when they can turn them off, etc. The whole camera in the courtroom business is interesting. In the trial I was in, they got a lot of public attention in 1980. There were no cameras in the courtroom. There were the little charcoal drawers. And they were very quiet, and they'd sit very, when we were all done, people always bought us our picture. You know, that was a nice thing to get your picture. When the case went to the Supreme Court of the United States on cameras in the courtroom, the best brief filed against it was filed by the Association of Charcoal Drawers. I just thought, how amazing, these people are concerned about our constitutional, our First Amendment rights. That's so funny. Well, you know, their market was going to dry up, so they hired a lawyer to write a brief against the constitutional brief. And it was a good one.
I have a question about witnesses. I'm from Los Angeles. My church is about 3 miles from the Brentwood estate. There was a lot of rumor around that area about people who actually saw things, but because they were well known and money, did not want to be summoned to court, did not want to tell anybody what they saw. Now, what's your take on how people get to, Cato Kalin made something out of it, but he didn't have much to lose. But how about people who are wealthy? Do they really want not to be made any more famous by this kind of thing? And would they not tell anything that they knew because they were afraid they'd be hauled in?
I think that's true. I think that, and this is a theme we've been kind of sounding all week, I think, we always assume that if these cases break down and we get the wrong result or we don't get all the evidence, that it's somehow the fault of the official police and this and that. The fact is, in a case of this type, 90% of the burden is on the regular community, the people who saw things and will come forward. 92% of the cases, of the criminal cases that are begun as a result of a citizen notifying the police and saying this happened and get out there. So it's not the police going out and finding the crime. It's the police waiting for it to be reported. So now you're talking now about a group of people who don't want to get involved.
Yeah.
They don't want to get involved. You know, the most famous example of that is the people in New York City who watch the a woman get beaten. And not only do not go out and help, you can understand that, there's personal safety, but do not make a phone call that this is happening. Remember that Kitty Genovese? That's a long time ago. 60s, I think. And there's that not get involved. And the same people who won't get involved then will blame the process when it breaks down. That's all part of it. I think the theme, at least for me, for the week, and we talked about it yesterday at the forum, is how do you take your own faults and project them on to other people and to the system? Yeah.
You'd asked a number of rhetorical questions, and I think the first one dealt with why did they hold the trial, I think, in Central LA versus in Brentwood. I think the Rodney King case, where I think they took it out of LA entirely.
And Simi Valley.
Yeah, Simi Valley, and it was, 100% white and whatnot, probably had a strong... I mean, they found him guilty, as I recall.
They found the police not guilty. The police were the defendants.
Correct, yeah.
They found them not guilty in the civil trial. Then the federal trial found them guilty, the subsequent federal trial, but not the state trial. So if I'm the prosecutor, why don't I take this case to a place like Simi Valley? I have that option. That's where you win. So let's take it where we lose. I mean, where we have a good shot. What am I thinking about?
Burning down L.A.
So we could be worried about what are the consequences. That's one possibility. What else?
Well, how about an appeal if it was found, you know, and use that fact that the all-white jury found him guilty?
Legal precedent, there's no way they could lose on that kind of an appeal. That's real square. They had the legal right to try it in that area. Then all they have to do is take a fair cross-section of that area.
No. Are you implying there might be influence we don't know about?
No, not implying that.
No.
I think there's one of two answers and maybe a little of both. The suggestion here that they were afraid of the repeat if they got a guilty verdict from an all-white jury. And I think that they thought that a guilty verdict from a mixed jury or a predominantly black jury would not only that the black community would take ownership of that verdict.
Yeah.
If it had been a guilty verdict, that they would be more likely to take ownership of it because the jury is made up of them. Also, I think there's a little bit of hubris involved. I think they felt they could not lose, that this case was deadlock, open and shut. We could try this to OJ's relatives and commit. And I think they got blindsided as far as that goes. I think I'll go back to another one, why they don't put in evidence of flight. I think they got snookered. I think that they believed that OJ was going to take the stand. And this is the rebuttal to O.J. taking the stand. The minute he takes the stand, all you're going to ask him about is this flight business with all the stuff in the car. He doesn't take the stand, and I think we all have a lot of ideas about why, but I think it would have been an incredibly ridiculous decision at that point, given how the trial had gone, to put him on the stand. We had an old saying, I used to do a lot of criminal defense, and our old saying went this way, your case is never better than the moment before your client takes the stand. Because criminal defendants have a way of saying very bad things.
You suggested earlier that a trial lawyer will not ask a question unless he knows the answer.
Yeah, not supposed to. They sometimes you have to ask.
Why did Chris Darden have OJ try on the gloves?
Well, it's a question that Marcia and Gil Garcetti asked him over and over after that. Demonstrations. Boy, if there's anything we teach students in the evidence courses, if you're going to do a demonstration in the courtroom of any kind, A, make sure you got all the variables controlled. Try it out ahead of time. One case, and I've seen them go wrong, and when they go wrong, I mean, this is your own test, and it's going wrong. Saw a defense, we had a products liability case in Chicago over a ladder, whether a ladder was safe or not. A woman had fallen off it and broken her leg. And so the defense, the company that made the ladder, had a little experiment to show that you couldn't hurt your leg on this ladder if you would simply use it properly. So they had the expert explain all this for an hour, and then had the expert walk up and down the ladder, and he fell off and broke his leg.
Why did they have the, I think it was the latex gloves under the, he had those on when he tried that?
Yeah.
I mean.
To not contaminate the evidence.
But, I mean, just the layer of the latex and the resistance of it, I mean, that's all I saw in, in the news, and I thought, I'd look at his face, you know, and it's, oh, wait a minute here, this really questioned that.
It's a wonderful example, isn't it, of what you make out of the glove business is almost 100% a function of what you brought to the glove business. If you thought he was set up and the whole thing wasn't there, when the gloves don't fit, you go, there it is. If you think that the police are doing a good job and all this, immediately your mind goes like, it could have shrunk, it's a long time, blah, 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 blah. People who spend time in prison, we know that their fingers get bigger, okay, for a lot of reasons, because of the way they're fed, because they don't get much exercise, especially if they're people who tend otherwise to get a lot of exercise. So I mean, there's a million reasons why the fact that the gloves don't fit are irrelevant if you start by wanting them to be irrelevant. If you think he's set up and the gloves don't fit, bing, the light goes off. There it is. That goes back to how do we interpret what we hear? What do we start with and why? And again, we can do better than we would if we weren't thoughtful about this. We can train ourselves to be more impartial. All I'm saying is that there's a point below which we can't get. There's a point where we can't get out of the way. We just do bring certain things to questions like that. Some people do it consciously, some do it subconsciously. Some you cannot persuade that they do it. I am absolutely absolutely impartial every time. That's, I just look at the facts. And the problem is facts always admit of a lot of odd interpretations in terms of what they, not only what they are, but what they mean. Yes, sir?
We haven't talked at all about the justice system as it's seen by black Americans, Afro-Americans. I read a very interesting little article in Harper's, November or December, written by a former prosecutor in the city of Washington. During the time that he was being trained, he was told that he was going to lose quite a few cases because the jurors would acquit a lot of people. He himself is, I guess they said he was an African-American. He points out the fact that one-third of all young black African males are somehow involved with the criminal justice system. As far as black Africans are concerned, the justice system isn't working for them. So he even went on to recommend that in certain cases where people weren't injured, that it would be a good thing for black Americans to acquit people, even though the evidence would suggest that that person is guilty. Another thing is, too, who is going to say that a god is guilty, especially if you have to go back and face your community, and if they have certain feelings about the justice system already, which are negative, how can you go as a African American to say, I found this man guilty? I guess my contention is that you'd never be able to convict Michael Jordan of almost anything.
Two different strains in there. One, what's the African American view of the criminal justice system? Changing to the extent that more African Americans are in the system in positions of power and ownership of the system is felt, that gets better. That's why, and incidentally, the O.J. Simpson trial has had one effect that you probably wouldn't guess. A huge increase in the interest in the law as a career among African Americans. Because that trial, if it said nothing else, said to them, you know, you can play in this system. You can be like Johnny. You can be like Mike, you can play basketball, you can be like Johnny. Frankly, I'm not sure I want him to be exactly just like Johnny, but you know what I mean in general. So the faith is increasing in the system, but it's historically been very low, and there's no secret why the faith in it has been very low. I had someone who just hated that verdict and came to me after this, a law student, very conservative law student, just absolutely beside himself, wanted me to explain how this could happen. This is my fault. That's my personal theory in life, is whatever goes wrong will eventually be my fault. I'm a Lutheran, you know, that's kind of the way we work. Right? How could this happen? And he said this: how could this happen? If this had happened in Alabama with a black man as a defendant, he would have gotten a public defender, the case would have been over in 3 days, and he would have been convicted. I said, yes. Now, which of these two results are you suggesting is more just? And then, this wasn't the 3 days and out for a serious murder case, and there wouldn't have even been any DNA testing. In that case, why do we need it, right? Incidentally, that's an interesting... Jim's been talking all week about invisible complexities and side effects. I love the thing on side effects. There's no such thing. But DNA test, you hear about that and you go, boy, if you're the prosecutor, isn't that great? I mean, here's a scientific test that, provided you don't contaminate it, provided you don't have dishonest police, you can tell all these things. You know what most prosecutors in smaller towns will tell you? Is they wish that test hadn't been invented. And you know why? Because it costs a tremendous amount of money to run it. And so now they don't run it in the run-of-the-mill case, and now we put the police on the stand, and here's the cross-examination. Did you run a DNA test? Well, no, we didn't. Isn't it true that the DNA test would prove almost conclusively whether or not my client committed the crime? Well, yes, that's true, but, oh, I see. So you let me say I have this straight. You have a test, which when run will tell almost exclusively whether or not my client committed the crime, and you have chosen not to run it. Is that correct? Oh, yeah, all the usual stuff. And instruct the witness to answer yes or no. Favorite lawyer game. You know, only answer yes or no. It's a little game. We tell you what answers, what are options. Right. So there's no yes, but yes if. So most prosecutors hate that DNA because either they have to run it every time or they have to get past this gauntlet of questions about why they didn't run it and what inferences are drawn from that. So it's funny how that works. We assume that that's the prosecutor's dream. It's a nightmare. Yes, sir?
You mentioned about taking the plumbing apart looking for blood. I gather they didn't find
it. No.
Do you have a theory? If indeed he did, let's assume he did for a minute, he got all his blood. How could he have gotten rid of the blood? Do you have any theories on that?
It's a contingent theory. It's a theory about if he did it, how did he get rid of it? I don't know. There's a million mysteries in this case. There's a million mysteries. One kind of fun game to play with this case is, and you're playing it now, assume that this is the right, assume he did it. You can line up 10 things now that you can't make sense of. Assume he didn't do it. You can line up another 10 things that you cannot make sense of. It's a real conundrum. There's all kind of oddities about this case. We may not have heard the last about this. You know, I think we have, but that's my personal opinion. And I'd be happy to tell you my personal opinion, except I want to tell you that my personal opinion is just as conditioned by what I brought to the case as anybody else's. Your attitude about the police is a big part of this. And I have a feeling that your attitude about police has a great deal to do with where you grew up, how you grew up, and how police treated you while you were growing up.
Yeah, I think that's the main reason that the Afro-Americans are so jubilant about it. I mean, they've been, you know, face it, they have had the shaft for so long.
Right.
You know.
Right. I grew up thinking a policeman was a man who told that's you where right. the ice cream store was. That's and right. if you yeah. didn't have a quarter to get in the movies, he would give you one. I'm making my age clear now with a quarter, right? Maybe it was even 15 cents. Well, most members of the African-American community, that's not the way they remember police. They weren't getting a quarter to go to the movies. Right? So I think the attitude that you have about police is a big part of how you view this case.
I would certainly agree with that. I work with a vice president who happens to be black, and he lives in a suburb of Minneapolis that is mostly white. His son was coming home one night and got stopped.
Sure.
Dragged out of the car, thrown up against the car, frisked, because he was going home.
Right.
Now, if you that has happened to you, that is going to make a huge difference for the rest of your life and how you view police.
I told you about my friend Derek, who's on teaches the same course as I do, criminal law at Valparaiso. He's been there for about 5 years. I've lived in Valparaiso 25 years, not counting when I was there as a student. I have been stopped probably 5 times by the Valparaiso police, all for justifiable reasons. Okay? Speeding, going through a red light, this, that, and the other. So number of times I've been stopped for inappropriate reasons is 0 in 25 years. I asked Derek, how often have you been stopped since you've been here? He's been here 5 years. And he said, oh, about once a week. Now, Valparaiso is no more racist than the next town. It's mostly white. It's predominantly white. But, I mean, the attitudes there are not crazy. Pretty common. But he drives a very expensive-looking car. And he's a young, good-looking black man. So, about once a week. Now, there comes a point where they learn his car and they learn him and then they know, oh, he's okay. But
would you say something about the civil trial that's going on with the OJ case?
There's a couple of them. I guess they're consolidated at this point. They're going to have all the evidence that was available to the prosecutors in the criminal case, and they're going to have a lot more. In a civil case, of course, you can force O.J. to talk, and they've already taken his deposition. So there's no Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, so he can be forced to talk. My guess is it's going to be hard for him to construct a kind of a plausible story. Easier for them to construct a plausible story. I think the plaintiffs are going to win the case. The damages are I don't know what they're going to be. There'll be some punitive damages, some compensatory damages. The damages are I don't want to shock anybody, but lawyers generally don't think death cases are really good damage cases. Damages tend to be much higher in a case in which a person is hurt and is going to have a lot of expenses and a lot of pain. It's going to cost a lot. So in a death case, at least if it's if there aren't a lot of people who are dependent on that person, so we don't have a wage loss situation, those are pretty small damages cases, unless you get the punitive damages in there. And they're going to be, I mean, that's a big part of what that lawsuit's about, is the size of the punitive damages.
Where will it be tried?
I'm not sure. I think they were filed in California, and they'll be tried somewhere in California, but where exactly, I don't know.
In a civil trial, do they have the same latitude as to the court that's going to be heard in?
They make a motion for venue.
They have a series of choices, but it's the plaintiff's choice there. So the plaintiff can put that case where the plaintiff wants to put it. My guess is they put it in Brentwood, huh?
Yes, I would think so.
Yeah. That's an appropriate venue because that's where it's alleged to have happened. That's an appropriate venue. That's a good venue for plaintiffs.
So the...
Why is it a good venue for plaintiffs? Not only are there a lot of white people, there are a lot of rich people. Rich people are good on juries when you have a damage case. We used to try cases down in Jasper and Newton counties in Indiana, all farmers. Okay. What a terrible place. The jury looks at you and you say, you want $5,000 for the broken arm? I've had two broken arms this month. There ain't no way helping me out. And even if I decide I'm going to give you some money, okay, I'll give you money. I'll give you a lot of money. I'll give you $100. So, I mean, Brentwood's a great place to put it for damage purposes.
But if you look at it from a standpoint of race relations in L.A., and we all assume that there will be a verdict in favor of the plaintiffs at this point, don't we go right back to reinforce all of the stereotypes and problems that exist?
I guess I doubt it in a civil case. I don't think a civil case has the same kind of moral meaning to people that a criminal case does. I could be wrong on that. This is a pretty high-profile case, but it's going to happen with a lot less fanfare and a lot more to it. One of the interesting questions, I want you to just... We're a little over time here. Just ponder this for a second. I'm guessing that most people in this room thought he was guilty and were shocked by the verdict. It's a guess, but it's probably a pretty safe guess. But let's say you didn't feel that way. One other thing is very interesting about this case. O.J. was acquitted, right? What's been the fallout? Because he was convicted in the press. He was convicted on TV. He was convicted in the minds of most people. That's a very, very interesting phenomenon to me. What we've really done is to have the case I was in, we lost but we won. This is another case where, you know, you really want to say the total experience is O.J. won? I find that, you know, in terms of his marketability, in terms of all kind of other things. He's free, but how free? You have all those kind of questions running around in this case, because it was two trials, and he won one and he lost one. And as I see, it was a tie in terms of that. Yes, sir.
Would you comment on the death penalty and why that was? I guess I found that kind of an interesting aspect of the case. Not that I wouldn't wish the death penalty on anyone, but I think it would have been interesting to see it kind of run its course, because it would have been probably one of the first times that we've actually had a face that everyone knew face the death penalty. Someone very well known, and I think it would have been very interesting to see America's reaction to trying to kill someone that we actually knew instead of this faceless person that committed some heinous crime.
It would have been sort of interesting sociology, I agree. I don't want to talk about the death penalty generally, because that's too big and we're out of time, and because if we really believed in the death penalty and what we're saying, we should put it on television anyway. I mean, but we'll talk about that. Why didn't they go for the death penalty? First of all, I don't think they wanted to have the lawyers for the defense be able to paint O.J. as a person fighting for his life. I don't think they wanted the rhetorical side of this person is fighting for his life. I think they felt they had a lot of problems and they didn't need that one. But I, in my wildest dreams, I don't imagine him ever being executed. I don't think the jury would have done it. I don't think if the jury had done it, the judge would have approved it. I don't think I just can't believe we would have let it happen. But if the death penalty had been there as an option, and if I were the prosecutor, I'd want it because it gives me leverage on the guilt verdict. The jury who's willing to say, well, I'll convict him, he did it, but he's not going to get the death penalty. It gives him a way to give something back, you know. You're kind of a winner, too. Yes, you committed murder, but with all of these circumstances you mentioned, blah, 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 we won't give you the death penalty. So I'm wondering why the prosecutor gave that up. It's always interesting leverage, not for a plea. But it gives the jury a way. What did they give the jury in this case? What was the compromise? Manslaughter? Give me a break. This is either murder or it's nothing. He either did it or he didn't. It's not manslaughter. Manslaughter are things where there's all kind of provocation and there's a fight and this and that. They gave the jury that option. I mean, why not just give them jaywalking as a kind of a way to compromise the case? We've gone way over. Thank you all very much.